I'm not going to do the farm animals, but I like the idea of comparing two novels together. It gives the whole thing a very Turing feel, since people's Goodreads ratings of the novels will be more implicit than, say, going to the bookstore and buying a book. The first thing we're going to need is a lot of sentences. Unfortunately, Harvard doesn't keep a public centralized sentence book, so I'm going to have to get all the books from the individual bookstores that people are using. Let the hacking begin. Okay, so I am here once again with Matthew Sharp, who's most recently the author of You Were Wrong. Matt, how are you doing?
I'm good, Ed. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. It's a pleasure to chat with you on this. Now, in by you, do you mean the reader? Who is the you that we're talking about here? That's probably a Abbott and Costello routine, I suppose.
The you and you were wrong?
Yeah.
I guess the reader could be implicated in that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, my cousin just wrote to me and said, couldn't you write a sequel that called You Are Right?
It's the bonus after you finish the first book. Well, I mean, I mention that because there isn't one point in the novel where you do address the reader directly or someone, you,
yeah,
when you bring up Carl's sex statistics. And it's the one time where you really explicitly break the fourth wall. And I was curious about that moment, how that came about and why in relation to sex.
Oh, gosh. I don't know. Probably some deep unconscious conflict that I have that I'm not aware of. I was under the impression, I mean, I haven't read my own novel in a while, but I was under the impression that I did that a few times, the breaking of the fourth wall thing.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I wanted to, you know, let's see, what to say about the address of the reader. Yes, I limited the point of view of the novel to Carl's, so that the reader doesn't at any moment know anything more than what Carl knows. And I was kind of obsessed in this book with questions, with what a literary critic friend of mine calls epistemophilia, which is the general tendency of stories to drive towards some kind of knowledge.
Yeah.
And so I wanted very much to implicate the reader in this quest for knowledge and how contested the whole question of knowledge is, or what we know, how we know it, what the solidity of the knowledge is. And so I created this guy who's just a complete bumbler when it comes to knowing things.
Yeah.
You know, somebody who is a mathematician, a field in which one would like to think there's some certainty about what you know, who's completely at sea in terms of interpreting every other kind of sign that he encounters in the world. And so, yeah, I wanted the reader to know more than this kind of foolish guy knows and have to confront that.
Varying yeah. degrees of knowledge, perhaps. For example, Carl has this arsenal of extremely obvious maxims. He says at one point, only people with happy childhoods have free will. And then later you write, as the narrator, there was no worse violation of the soul than hope. Why these deliberately generic maxims? Largely to reflect Carl's haplessness, or to essentially nudge the reader along that there are additional nuggets of wisdom going beyond the relationship of the reader to Carl, the protagonist here.
Wait, can you say that again? Sorry.
Oh, yeah. So, I mean, I wanted to just kind of get at the role of the...
Can you touch on a little bit, please, what you mean?
I wanted to get at the sort of... the role of the generic maxims in this novel and how they serve to reflect these levels of knowledge you were talking about in the previous answer.
Yeah, I think I probably wasn't always aware from sentence to sentence using free and direct discourse whether I was inhabiting Carl's head or the narrator's head. And I did want that line to be somewhat blurred. So I can't honestly tell you in the writing of those, I know what you're talking about with the different aphorisms or maxims, but I can't honestly tell you whether I was thinking as the narrator in those moments or thinking as Carl in those moments. But I imagine, I think that every sentence in the book is a little bit stained with Carl's yeah. consciousness. So yeah, it's just, you know, just him trying to assert truth statements about a world that is far too confusing for him to make any more deep or serious or profound truth statements about.
These shifting vantage points that you're talking about, I'm wondering if this also explains the differing sentence styles throughout the book. I mean, the book, to my mind, is an oscillation game. I mean, it starts in its most explicit mode, perhaps, with the rat's eye Carl versus the pool table Carl. But as we continue to read the book, we see characters moving left, right, left, right. We are constantly presented with varying dichotomies. And then, of course, these numerous sentences, sometimes with extremely strange modifiers attached to nouns, and sometimes with just bizarre syntax. And I'm curious how random this was, and how planned this was, or how many voices did you want to present within this, you know, comparatively slim book? It's there's quite a number of them.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think that's just to do with wanting to have as we all have, a single voice that embodies many different voices and moods and, you know, registers and, you know, the way that we are all these kind of amalgams or collages of different ways of talking.
Yeah.
It was probably even more than my other novels. It was an improvisation. I didn't really, even though I wanted to, I sort of had this paradoxical goal of creating a very highly plotted novel with lots of twists and lots of revelations and lots of surprises and, you know, driving toward this kind of noirish conclusion.
Yeah.
At the same time as I was improvising my ass off, if I may use that word.
Absolutely. You can use every kind of word in the book.
Okay, yeah.
Particularly the verboten ones.
Oh, good. So it could be that the I don't know if you would call it the schizophrenia of the voice was in keeping with my own schizophrenic goals for the book, or I should say the contradiction between my goal and my mode of working. Yeah.
Does that improvisational nature explain in part why the book is so violent? I mean, it has the rather extremely creative usage of a pool cue against a gentleman's head, which I thought was a very idiosyncratic form of violence. I'm curious why the book was so violent, number one. Number two, how you settled upon the pool cue to the head. That's not an easy thing to do, you know. The head was going to move around.
It's not an easy thing to
hit the head,
brain someone with a pool cue.
Yeah, no.
Yeah, well, if it's an old guy and he's not expecting it. I don't know. Let's see. Why was it so violent? That's a really hard question to answer. I think that's just, it's not a part of my temperament as a social being or even as a private individual in his house. But for whatever reason, when I write fiction, I guess I'm on the lookout for conflicts and in some way pain and impediments. And as my friend, the writer Lynn Din says, the body is the first and last metaphor. And if you want to show someone in difficulties, show somebody whose body is being impinged upon.
But you also are playing a bit of a marionette here with these characters. Or these characters serve as marionettes because you often have Sylvia, for example. You are extremely specific about the way she sits on the bed, about her posture. And speaking of the body, there's also much imagery with the face, particularly in relation to Carl and how he views people. In fact, one of the curious things about this book that I have to ask you about is Carl perceives Sylvia only in terms of the color and the general generic item of clothing, like a blue shirt or an indigo bra and whatnot. And that goes throughout the entire book, and there's probably about, I don't know, 7 or 8 of them. So how did you arrive at that sort of generic syntax, that shorthand for Carl perceiving Sylvia, and what of this idea of these characters placed in very specific forms of posture? I mean, to some degree it's very hyper-specific, to some degree it's very almost, you know, math-like in its generic description as well, in terms of from Carl's perspective.
Yeah, wow, you notice stuff that nobody else notices, by the way, so I have to think about these
no
my
problem.
Answers. But I just actually want to circle back to a question I didn't answer, which is the pool cue. I really wanted to place the pool table and the piano next to each other because I wanted this very much to be a novel about a bourgeois home.
Yeah.
Of the kind that I grew up in, though luckily I didn't grow up with the kind of family that Carl
I would hope so.
But I was thinking at that moment of the beating on the head of John Millington Synge's Playboy of the Western World.
Yeah.
Which I'm sort of deciding whether to give away a major plot surprise. I think I probably won't give it away. But that's a novel in which a guy walks into a bar in a strange town at the beginning of that play, having just beaten his father with some kind of implement. I can't remember what kind, but he beats him in the head. And so I was thinking, okay, how do I transport Synge's rural Irish play to Long Island at the beginning of the 21st century? And I thought, okay, I actually can't remember right now what he beats him with. Maybe a farming implement. So I'm thinking, okay, what would be handy in a house like this? So that's the answer to that question. About the careful description of the people's bodies and their postures, I think I just became fascinated through Carl's eyes with the body of his beloved, which he is very, very attuned to because he really, really digs it. And he's constantly looking, like, he just is fascinated by her body. And Carl, knowing in a sense that he has maybe something like what we would call Asperger's or, you know, some kind of weird disorder where he's not very good at reading faces. He's always trying super hard to read faces, and he really thinks, you know, if I can only learn the vocabulary of facial expressions, I will finally be able to decipher what the hell people are ever intending toward me.
And yet the narrator offers a tell by saying at one point that Carl was as clueless about bodies as he is about faces. And yet he's trying in his own way, even when he looks into a face-sized pool of blood and to see his own reflection. It's almost as if you as the author are not really giving him much of a chance, even as he is making this effort to try to perceive the world around him. Which leads me to wonder whether there is any real validity to the world if he's essentially a puppet for you to go ahead and bounce around and to have him attack other characters and the like.
I didn't perceive him as a puppet. I tried to give him, you know, perhaps not so much dignity, but certainly volition. I mean, he's, as the reviewer in the Times pointed out, he's not a guy whose motivations are always terribly clear to the reader, let alone to himself. So he's acting quite irrationally much of the time, but I didn't mean for him to be a puppet. I just meant for him to be a somewhat hapless guy who gets thrust into lots of weird situations in a row.
Yeah. I also wanted to ask, going back to this description issue, after the identity of Sylvia's father is revealed, the text suddenly pays attention to the apparent fact that Sylvia has pale, taut skin. And this is interesting because, you know, as before, we've only had, like, rose-colored t-shirt indigo bra beforehand. And I'm curious why you allowed Carl that revelation. Did he just is this going back to what you were describing earlier on this conversation about the fact that there are various aspects of knowledge with which both the reader and the character are able to grab, and when they grab those, they, I suppose, get a little nudge forward, a little reward for their efforts?
That's something like that. I mean, I do remember. I do think that he notices her pale, I don't know about the taut part of her skin, but he notices the paleness of her skin a number of times, including in the first, I think it's in the first chapter, and there is a very specific reason for this that I am not going to say, that is one of the surprises in the plot, his noticing of her various features of her physiognomy, and my reason is to, I guess critics call this prolepsis, right? Where there's a revelation to come or a plot point to come, and you begin to set it up even surreptitiously.
Yeah. I wanted to also ask you about the gas station register, Jen. She serves almost no real function to the book or to the story, and yet you're very careful to always describe her every time he passes by the gas station, even though she's not doing anything in relation to the story, so to speak. And I'm wondering why that was.
I don't know. I just liked her there in the background, just as I suppose she's a stand-in for this entourage of people who are always in the background and only once or twice named in the book, and she just is the one that I decided to name repeatedly. One of those recurring motifs in the book. You know, I think it's in Lolita that Nabokov talks about, well, Humbert is, he keeps, in order to describe why he's so appealing to Lolita's mother, he keeps saying something like, yeah, I'm really sorry to do this, but I need to remind you now, dear reader, that I'm actually quite handsome. It's not because I'm vain, it's just because I want you to understand why Dolores, or what's the mother's name? Why she's so taken with me. And he says, periodically I'm going to allude to my own handsomeness in the way that if a character shows up at the beginning of a novel with a dog, he's stuck with the damn dog for the rest of the novel. So I suppose Jen is just one of those sort of recurring things just to remind you of the milieu of that Sylvia operates within.
Because for me, I was wondering if Jen was one of those opportunities, like, how do I plunge further and make Jen more of a part of the story, well, I can't quite do it, so I'll just keep her there as a placeholder. Is this how much of your novels have been, where you've always had these little placeholder characters, and you've always tried to figure out where they fit into the grand equation?
I think that probably at the beginning considered the possibility that Jen would become a substantial player in the novel at some point, or would have a you know, substantive cameo, and then she didn't, and then I just thought, okay, there she is. I kind of like her there in the background, never very clearly described, you know, behind the cash register or sitting around a table of a lot of people. Yeah. It's just, you know, there's a lot of whim and whimsy that go, you know, as I think Michael Caine, the actor, once said about his wife, she has a whim of iron. So it is my whim of iron that I keep Jen in the novel, though she doesn't do much.
I also wanted to ask you about Larchmont and Jones's tendency, going back to the knowledge thing, to offer all this esoteric trivia in lieu of trying to get Carl to like him. I mean, he goes on about Chopin, the Steinways, the BQE. You know, I mean, this guy is like an endless reservoir of you know, interesting yet completely impertinent information, or information that's impertinent to the particular social situation. And I'm wondering how that came about. Was it, to my mind, it seems to me that Larchmont's long soliloquies functioned in almost the same way that the sort of sections of the book where there's like all these one-line dialogues break up the flow of the book a bit, so that after you've had this extremely bizarre descriptive syntax, you then get a little bit of a break with these, like, you know, nothing but dialogue, and then you go back to that. Similarly, you also have the Larchmont rants and the Larchmont soliloquies. I'm curious how you balanced all this and how this the rhythm originated.
Yeah, I think I wanted him to represent a kind of worldliness, and I wanted him to be a businessman who was also somewhat of a man of letters, somewhat of a polymath, somebody who would have arcane information, and who is just an overbearing monologuist, and who, for lack of understanding how to genuinely connect with his stepson, you know, force feeds him all these weird bits of information, like the history of the Steinway piano, or, as you say, the BQE. I can't remember what his other, but just somebody who basically can't help himself,
yeah.
and is unable not to share his what he considers to be this wonderful gift of his arcane bits of knowledge. I do want to, you've alluded a couple of times to the bizarre syntax of some of the sentences in the purely narrational parts of the novel. So I do want to give a shout out to my buddy Henry James, who was a big
really?
Presiding spirit in this book. Yeah, uh-huh. Yeah, and not only in the scene. I mean, you know, I could never hope to write sentences of the kind that James writes, but yeah, there was a little bit. I had read a bunch of James novels right before I started writing this book, and he is,
really?
I consider him a presiding spirit in a number of ways. One, I wouldn't say that I wouldn't know how to imitate a James sentence, and it would be a horrible car crash if I were to try to, but something like wanting the sentences to be as sensitive instruments of knowledge and perception as I could make them, and of the curlicues of the human mind. And so, yeah, I was trying to stretch the syntax of my sentences almost unto breaking point in order to achieve, on the one hand, a great sensitivity in the sentence, and on the other hand, always being in danger of falling apart into the sort of chaos and befoggedness that a lot of the novel, or certainly the protagonist of the novel, operates in. So I wanted the sentences to have the possibility, hold out the possibility of offering great knowledge, and then sort of teeter on the edge of absurdity.
That's really interesting about James, because now I have to ask you if you even attempted to dictate the novel just as James did. We're talking early James or later James after that dictation point.
I think I read novels on either side of the Rubicon.
Okay.
I read some of the late ones that he would have dictated, and some of the early ones that he was writing himself.
Yeah.
No, I don't think I could. I mean, Richard Powers does that too, the dictation thing. And I suppose if I got as bad writer's cramp as James had, I would figure out a way around it. But to me, the book feels anyway so written, and writing is a very different experience for me than talking. I don't think I could talk those sentences.
Did you try to get some of those sentences deliberately bad or deliberately odd in an effort to sort of work away from the James influence or the James yoke? I mean, at what point did you just sort of say, well, this is kind of running on its own idiosyncratic steam. Therefore, forget James. I'm going to try to go ahead and make this sharp, you know?
Yeah. Well, like I said, I wasn't consciously trying to make a sentence that is exactly like a James sentence. I just trusted that if I attempted to do something that felt Jamesian in its style, that it wouldn't be. Anyway, there's no way that I can do it, and so I just trusted that my failure to make a James sentence might in itself produce an interesting sentence.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How much of your work has been about getting some results out of failed forgery?
A lot. Yeah, I think I'm always there's always in this novel there was a sort of hodgepodge of presiding spirits. Probably the main one is James. Also, because James's novels, even though they are so much about these finely wrought perceptions, also have these really muscular plots.
Yeah.
I often have this experience in a James novel where I'm slogging through the first 150 pages going, oh, come on already. Yeah. And then finally around page 150 or something, I suddenly see how the teeth of the gears are touching one another. I'm like, oh man, now I gotta find out how he wraps this up.
Yeah.
So I did want to make a plot too, but let's see. Let me review my novels. With the first one, Nothing Is Terrible, I was very consciously rewriting Jane Eyre. So Charlotte Bronte, at least, I mean, probably spiritually, it's closer to Louis Ferdinand Céline, or at least, you know, my attitude in the writing of it was more akin to something down and dirty like Céline, but I was very much following the plot of Jane Eyre.
Yeah.
Then for The Sleeping Father, I was trying to channel, not in the plot and not in the characterizations, but in the relation of the narrator to the characters, I was trying to channel George Eliot in Middlemarch. And Jamestown, again, a hodgepodge, but certainly Joyce and Beckett and were people that I was thinking about, and Murakami to some extent, and a great favorite of mine, teenage years, Joseph Heller, Catch 22. So this is something that is just a byproduct of being an avid reader and working with language, and you know, as our buddy Mary Gateskill says, I'm not actually listing the people that I am influenced by. I'm listing the people that I hope I am influenced by.
At what point, though, do you walk away from influence? Do you basically say, all right, I've got out the trains to run on the locomotive track, but I'm building the track here, and therefore these are my trains, and I can't read any other writer. I have to keep going with this.
It's funny that you mentioned the train and track metaphor, because I often, have you ever seen that Wallace and Gromit movie? I think it's called The Wrong Trousers.
Yes.
Where the guy's like, I think it's the dog who's steaming full steam ahead on the toy train around the living room, but he doesn't have enough track, so he's kind of laying as
down,
the train is hurtling along. I kind of feel like that's the experience of writing a novel.
Yeah.
Is, you know, like you're laying track as the train is about to hurtle off into space. I don't seem to ever sweat the influence thing very much. It doesn't seem to. I figure if my influence or my imaginary influence is a 19th century novelist, I so know that I won't be able to imitate that style, and I'm so uninterested in imitating the style that I feel free to take from it whatever nourishes me. So I don't get too. I mean, I'm aware of these presiding spirits in my novels. They help me. They don't seem to hinder me very much. And I guess I'm not worried about being too much like those people, because I know I just can't be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I also wanted to ask you, I have to ask you about the vomiting. We open up in the first chapter with lots of vomiting. But it's interesting because that's the physical vomiting that is described. Later, when you have Carl and Sylvia discussing Arv, there's another mention of vomiting, but it's just merely mentioned. It's off screen, so to speak. And then you have metaphorical vomiting later when Sylvia says something later in the book. So we have vomiting from a number of different vantage points, and I'm curious as to why that is. I don't want to give away the last part because it's tied into a plot development. But
oh yeah,
yeah, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah.
What can I say? I like vomiting. It's been pointed out to me that I return to that theme, if you can call it a theme.
Regurgitate that theme, so as it were.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's a long vomiting scene in Jamestown, and there are a couple of references to vomit in The Sleeping Father. I think I'm just fascinated with the vagaries of the body, and one of them being when your food doesn't stay down.
Yeah.
And of course, it lends itself quite readily to metaphor when you talk about, as we just did, you talk about regurgitating the vomit theme. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's involuted.
I'm a Jewish guy, and we tend to like vomit and fart and shit humor.
Yeah, yeah. So. I mentioned the fourth wall in my first question to you, but I actually have something in my notes here that I wanted to ask you about, sort of related to the idea of breaking the fourth wall. And there's one point where the narrator writes, "Tones can be tough for everyone, and we're extra tough for Carl, who was lately an avid pupil in the urgent remedial project of tones." There are a number of things about that. One, the question is whether the narrator is upbraiding Carl or the reader, but the fact is this also reminds me of one thing you do frequently in this book, and that is repeat a word like tones, as you do in that sentence, over and over again, as if to suggest that here is the painfully obvious answer that is repeated in the sentence, and yet at the same time, the reader has to ask, is this sentence telling us anything, or is it just kind of bullshit? So I'm curious about this.
Yeah, I do like repetition. I think repetition is the friend of the artist, the inevitable companion of the artist. And so I'm probably driven as much by the sound of the sentence as by its meaning. So in that particular sentence, I really was just looking for a beautiful and somewhat humorous repetition of this word. And yes, hint, hint, tone, yeah. And then, yes, I suppose I was also maybe trying to imitate the experience of a mind running over something again and again, like, is this significant? Do I need to make sense of this? Should I try to make sense of this? Is there some significance here? I'm trying to make sense, you know, that weird, I mean, I don't know, maybe your mind doesn't do this, but I have this almost kind of autistic, you know, davening way of I'm a somewhat compulsive thinker in my own silent brain life.
Would you say that by and large you were more driven to a sentence by its sound than its meaning? Or,
you know, it's hard to know. You're just sitting there, or in my case, lying there a lot. I mean, because I have back problems, I wrote a lot of this book lying down.
Yeah.
It's both. Mm-hmm. Yeah, as my former professor, the poet William Matthews said, it's always both, and it's always your mother.
Yeah.
So,
is there? This makes me also want to ask if specific phrases haunt you, and you find some way to work them into the novel or the project you're working on at any given time. If it's all about the sound like this.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I carry around a notebook, and I'm always jotting down phrases that pop into my head, or certainly lots of overheard conversations, and so yeah, I'll often. I mean, the sentence will usually. If I'm in the middle of a novel, I don't know if this happens to you, but I start the novel starts to be a lens through which I perceive the world, and so everything in the world starts to resemble my novel or seem like it's potential material for the novel. So. So I don't think there's ever the case where I'm purely besotted by the sound of a sentence and want to put it in the book only for its sound quality. It's usually some combination of this feels like the ideal set of words with which to describe this particular set of circumstances that this character is in.
But it seems to me that you are besotted by the novelistic prism. This could actually possibly be a hazard. I mean, some novelists say that when they're working on a novel and they experience this very common conundrum, they have difficulty interacting, or they turn into, as John Banville once said, I turn into a wild animal, and that kind of thing. Do you have any sort of experiential social problems particularly with this character, because he's like so intense and so autistic and so driven by this mathematical way of framing the world? That's, you know, I mean, how do you separate your everyday dealings with this mad character on the page?
Well, it's more like I feel socially awkward on a fairly regular basis.
You feel socially awkward anyway? Or?
Yeah, not to the degree that Carl does, but of course, it was my social awkwardness that inspired Carl's.
Yeah.
And I heart hyperbole, so I thought, okay, how far can I stretch this and still have a legitimate character?
Yeah.
By virtue of having to have day jobs for most of my adult life in conjunction with the writing, I'm always having to switch back and forth really quickly between work situations and solitary novel writing situations. So I'm pretty good at not. I mean, yeah. I mean, I'm a weird reclusive writer type. So I stay in my house a lot, and sometimes don't go out for days. But it doesn't seem to cause greater than average social difficulties for me.
I wanted to ask just about, talking about the precision of the description. I want to give the listeners here some idea of what we're talking about. For example, the mid-afternoon sunbeam that entered the house through a bedroom window to the right in the first chapter. Exceptionally precise. It almost reads like some director offering hyper-specific stage directions in a shooting script. But there's also a moment in which a character is asked for his motivation, and there's also a point where Jones is quoting eyebrow raises in cinematic history. The Hollywood motif in this book, I'm curious if where this came from. Did this book originate in any form as a sort of a play or a script in any sense? Because it's almost stage direction like, particularly in the first part. And then as we get along, it moves into other territories. But I found that to be quite interesting.
I am a compulsive movie watcher, so I do watch hundreds of movies a year. I guess I would say that I did want to make that suburban house into a kind of stage set, or rather, to put it another way, I think that suburban houses already are stage sets, and so I wanted to highlight and emphasize that feature of suburban designed space in general, or even non-designed space. There's this great sociologist who I think has had a profound effect on my thinking as a writer, Irving Goffman, and he has this book called The Presentation of Self in Everyday Life, in which I think he was one of the really early thinkers in the 20th century to articulate that life is a kind of performance, that I think of him as a sort of avatar of the social constructivists. So he goes into elaborate detail about how life is a performance, how the personality of any individual is a kind of performance, and getting back to that question of the multifarious narrative voice of the novel and my comment about any given person's voice being a kind of collage of different voices. The waiters in this restaurant are going to talk one way in this sort of stylized waiter way to their customers, but when they go home to their families, they're going to talk in a completely different tone, register, set of vocabulary.
All of us are guilty of that to some degree.
Yeah. So in that sense, the personality and the self is a kind of performance, and designed spaces like suburban homes facilitate that performance, and they in fact prescribe different activities depending on which part of the house you're in. So you wouldn't want to take a shit in the kitchen. You wouldn't want to cook dinner in the bedroom. You get these. So yes, I was very conscious of what activities are performed in which part of the house. And in fact, when I was thinking, all right, how do I get this novel going? What's my, to use the movie term, inciting incident, a term that I've always found really redundant, because aren't inciting an incident have the same root? So it's like saying beginning, speaking of repetition. But
beginning
anyway,
going.
So when I was thinking, how do I get this novel going? I want to write about this sad sack guy who's in some way stuck in his house and has an opportunity to leave the house. I thought, well, what do? I'll stick someone in the house who doesn't belong there. So she is, she is matter out of place. She is a creature who does not belong in that house, who is not properly part of the prescribed stage set of Carl's private home.
Yeah.
So I think I was thinking very consciously about the theatrical quality of the house, and a lot of this is unconscious, but now that I'm thinking about your question about the movements of the bodies, I think in a sense I am the choreographer or I am the playwright, and I was doing blocking. I was moving these people around the stage.
Or the puppeteer. I mean, objects seem to have more description at times than the actual motions of the people. And sometimes that's why I make, and I don't mean this as a diss, by the way. I mean this is a very as curious priority on your part. This idea that really it's all about objects rather than people. That's just
like what when you say objects, like,
well, even
what
going back to what we were talking about earlier, the Steinway next in so close to the pool table, we're more familiar with that than any possible consummation between Sylvia and Carl, which, I mean, I don't want to give it away, but theirs is essentially an aesthetic relationship, and even Carl's dealing with that house or cleaning up the kitchen, it's all about kind of a role of moving objects as opposed to wanting to relate to people.
Yeah, well, I do think that we are very determined by our objects. And here again, this was not a conscious decision on my part. But yeah, I think the things that we accouter ourselves with are a very important part of our identities. Mm-hmm. You know, which soap you use, which soap I use constitutes Matt.
Yeah,
well, I mean, a friend of mine came into my house and saw that there was oil of Olay, or, you know, Olay soap in my bathroom, and she said, "Listen, if you're trying to score with a chick, do not have the Olay soap out." So that would be an example of the way a purchased object could be perceived as a reflection on my identity.
But it also goes back to the posters that Carl has in his room, which he's condemned for by Sylvia and later on in the book by the narrator himself or herself, whatever. But I'm wondering if it's absolutely fair to use the phrase specifically that you use, is posters losing their luster through repetition. Well, on some level, Carl's going to have a repetitive life. He does have a repetitive life. Going, and at one point, you describe him going job, home, job, home, job, home. Yeah. And so the question is even though what he's doing is cyclical, and even though what he's doing is something that a lot of other human beings do, the question is where does the originality of his existence even begin? Or it's almost like you're denying him that as the writer.
Yeah, I didn't mean to deny him originality, but I did mean to. I mean, that was just the repetition that the narrator is referring to there is not the repetition of Carl's repeated viewings of these posters, but the fact that the posters that he has, Gustav Klimt's The Kiss, Hendrix at Monterey, these are posters that are
everywhere,
that are on the walls of millions and millions of teenagers and 20 somethings throughout the world. So, So yes, there. I mean, this is the paradox and the conundrum of personality is that, you know, here I am wearing my American Apparel T-shirt and my Saucony shoes and my Calvin Klein socks and my, you know, Fruit of the Loom underwear, and yet, perhaps falsely, I like to perceive myself as an individual, even though I am coated in, you know, product. As Carl is. So my hope is that a reader would perceive him as a rather idiosyncratic and odd individual, even as he is being impinged upon by all these bought things.
But that idiosyncratic framing, I think, comes from the sentences at times and the strange juxtapositions of objects rather than any particular existential choice that he makes. I mean, he's kind of, you know, he has two views, you know, the rat's hole or the
rat's
pool table.
Eye view, yeah.
The rat's eye view or the pool table, or in the case of his Volvo, the back seat or the driver's seat. It's like you're delimiting his choices to these dichotomies, which, I mean, I'm not trying to do this as a point of criticism, but more as an observation about the book, that by narrowing his ontological choices and describing them in a way that nobody else would write about, it's functioning with a kind of stylistic irony, and I'm wondering.
Yeah, that's a nice way to put it. Yeah,
I mean, but I'm wondering if this is becoming increasingly a dilemma, this notion that, well, if we're all organization men, if we're all conforming to some agreed upon existential codex, then how can we write novels?
Well, it's a challenge. Yeah, it's a. I mean, yes, you write, you know that it's actually not so easy to have an original voice, and if not original thoughts, then certainly, you know, fully realized novelistic thoughts that are going to be compelling. So, yeah, I mean, maybe this is one of those things where I was trying to write my way out of the bind of writing a novel, which is the bind of experiencing myself as just a schlub like a million other guys sitting at home trying to write novels and yet trying to do something authentic, original, interesting, you know, insightful. I think with Carl, I was giving him a rather difficult hole to dig himself out of, and his/my way of digging himself out of the hole being his limited ability to know and perceive, and his not being perhaps a terribly interesting guy if you were to encounter him in a bar. My way of digging myself out of this was to try to come up with sentences that would nonetheless allow a reader to register him as a human being. Yeah.
Well, on that note, that seems a very good moment to close this conversation. But Matt, thanks so much for taking the time. That was a pleasure.
Oh, yeah. Thanks, Ed.
All right.
Last time that we had this conversation, I decided we should be friends.